Anthony Horowitz is here. He's the writer of all the Alex Rider books. The first one has been... you're the screenwriter, aren't you? I mean, and it says adapted from
the
novel.
Yeah, I'm the adapting my own book, so, yeah, it makes me a screenwriter.
How many changes did you have to make?
A lot. It was quite difficult. I didn't want to do it at first. In fact, I tried to talk myself out of the job because I was quite nervous about taking my sort of, you know, my little precious jewel and chopping it up. But somebody had to do it, and the producers suggested it would be best if it was me.
We've spoken to you many times, and we talked about the Alex Rider books and about horror movies and horror books, and you're writing horror stuff for children. I'll talk to Mark Kermit about that in just a moment. But having written those novels for so long, to go to your first premiere a few days ago and walk up the red carpet, that must have been one of the best feelings in the world.
It was an extraordinary experience, I can tell you, and very strange in a way, because you know, you see these things on television, everybody's always saying, you know, it's fantastic, it's amazing, it's wonderful. Look, it is all those things, but for me I was disconnected from it. I couldn't believe it. So I spent hours and hours on my own in a room just writing books and stories and scripts and whatever. And suddenly to find myself out there with, like, I think there were 1,500, even 2,000 people in Leicester Square. And, you know, they were mainly after seeing Alex, but there were people there with books too. And, you know, it was just something I'm just not used to. It's so outside my experience. It was like being on a foreign planet.
Was it the strength of the sales that actually sold it in the end to a big company? Because there have been other movies that look at the spy genre from a kid's point of view, Cody Banks and so on, Spy Kids. Was that a problem in trying to sell the idea in the first place?
Cody Banks was a big problem. It came along, I think, just after I'd finished writing Skeleton Key, the third book in the series. And by then the option had been sold and the scripts were written and we were sort of beginning to move towards production. Suddenly Cody Banks turned up and, of course, everything stopped. And that was sort of annoying and irritating. But then, fortunately, it sort of came and went again. And
not quite as annoying and irritating as the film itself.
I wasn't going to say that. I wouldn't want to comment. I thought it wasn't so bad, the first one. The second one, they made the mistake of doing it very quickly and cheaply, making a second one, which more or less killed their own franchise. But as to the offers, you know, you asked about, you know, how it happened. I was very glad and grateful that we did make this in Britain. This is actually a British film. I know, you know, no one to be jingoistic and flag-waving, but I think we can be quite proud of the fact that here we are finally taking on the Americans at their own game, producing a really big action-adventure film with all the sort of chases and action you'd expect from sort of Bruce Willis or Spider-Man or whoever, but doing it on our own terms. So I'm very happy about the way it's all turned out.
What would it take for this? We're sort of joking about it becoming a franchise, but what does it take? Is it just box office receipts? Is that the only thing that will make the difference?
The film business is so different to the book business because, you know, it really is instant success or instant failure. I mean, you talked about Cody Banks disappearing. It did, because the second film, its opening weekend, didn't work, and that's it. Cody who, suddenly? So look, with us, everybody, these money people, producers, are going to be looking at the figures this weekend in England, but even more importantly, dare I say it, in America in October when the film opens, you know, will it perform there? Because a film these days, it costs, I think, $40 million, which is an awful lot of money. To recoup that, they've got to be successful all over the world. So they look at these figures very, very carefully, they make their calculations, and then we get either the green light or not.
Will how it does in Britain affect at all how it does in the States?
I think it will. I mean, there was a big piece on it in the New York Times only yesterday or the day before, which was entirely down to the fact that the premiere in Leicester Square was so huge. I mean, it really was a rock star event, and it caught their attention, so suddenly they're publicising it as well. And I think if the film is a success here, it will travel to America as a special film rather than just, you know, another film from somewhere far away, and it will help over there, yeah.
Mark Kermode joins us now. We're doing movie reviews on a Wednesday because it's the Open Golf starts tomorrow, so there's no place for Mr. Kermode on Friday afternoon. So on a rather strange Wednesday afternoon, Mark
You've
Kermode,
got that
hello.
Friday feeling, right?
Yeah, a bit of a Friday feeling, and joining us from doubtless a very air-conditioned studio in Southampton.
Yes, our air-conditioned cupboard down here in Southampton.
And did Stormbreaker make it into your preview screening room?
Yeah, I think Stormbreaker was fun. I mean, it's interesting what you're saying about this issue with the American box office, and this is absolutely right. Stormbreaker will almost certainly be a big hit here. I mean, it's got all the right ingredients. It's got a PG certificate, which is right because it means it plays to as young an audience as it needs to. The BBFC rating notes moderate violence, and that's it. The question is whether or not that then translates to America. And unfortunately, and Anthony Horowitz is completely right about this, what defines the future of movies, sadly, is how they perform around the rest of the world. Now, it's got all the constituent elements there. It's got all the things, you know, on the page that should make it a success. And one hopes that if it's a big success here, that the Americans say, oh, well, fine, you know, the Brits have got something that we haven't got. Let's have a slice of it. But, I mean, I always sort of live in terror of what happened to Thunderbirds, which was the Thunderbirds, which I actually thought was a fun movie. movie, you know, died on both sides of the Atlantic. This will not. This will do well here, and it would be great to see it doing well in America as well. But the Americans are just such a weird audience. Sometimes they just take against things for not being American. I'm inclined to think that they will actually take this, you know, to their heart, because, you know, it's a great fun romp. It's got loads of action set pieces in. It's got a vision of London which is internationally recognisable. You know, you recognise it immediately as you know, the key constituent points of London. I have to say, I think it's the best advert for the Isle of Man that we've seen for quite a long time, because the Isle of Man, it's not Cornwall. All the Cornwall stuff is the Isle of Man, and boy, the Isle of Man looks really good.
You are quite boring about the Isle of Man.
I'm sorry, but it's a regular basis. No, but it's absolutely true. There is a reason, other than just tax, why so many movies, so many British movies get shot in the Isle of Man. It's because the Isle of Man, for a very small island, looks like a lot of different places. And I guarantee you that most people who don't know what Port Erin Beach looks like will not say, oh God, that's not Cornwall. So, you know, it's a good-looking movie. It's a fast-paced movie. It zips along at a nice speed. Like I said, it's got a PG rating, which is good, because there are too many things at the moment with 12A certificates that you can't take younger kids, you know, to go and see. And so its target audience is able to go and see it, and there isn't anything that's going to, you know, put them off, and that's right and as it should be. It's got a brace of fine British performers. I mean, people don't mention, for example, Andy Serkis, who I think Andy Serkis is great in absolutely everything. And it's a speechless role in this, but he's very, very funny. And, of course, you know, Bill Nye is very funny, chews the scenery up in fine style.
Go on.
I was just going to say, but what I would really like to happen is for the Americans then to say, OK, great, because that is the thing that will guarantee the ongoing success. I mean, it's a shame, because one would really wish that just on the strength of British box office, you could guarantee an ongoing series. But as we all know with Bond, I know Anthony Horowitz said this isn't Bond, but there are comparisons to be made here. The reason Bond carries on is because it's a success everywhere, not just in the domestic territory.
It must be agony, Anthony, really. I mean, you know, I temper my sympathy for you, knowing that you're going to have an extremely successful movie clocking up. But to come in and sit and listen to someone doing a critique of something which has dominated your life for the last 6 years...
Well, Mark, just now, well, actually, he was very kind. I thought he was going to be was in a different studio, because he was about to sort of come really lay into the film, and you didn't want me to be too close to him.
I've been in the same studio with people who I've been unpleasant to.
You were very pleasant, Mark, and thank you very much for your comments. And I agree with absolutely everything you're saying, and especially about the shame of it, that, you know, that America does have to be the big test for these films. All I can say is that we do have two things on our side. The first is that we've sold an awful lot of Alex Rider books in America, so at least there is a sort of a built-in audience of kids who want to go and see this film. And that, of course, is the big difference between us and Bond, which is that we are kid-led. You know, Bond belongs to the adults, but Alex really does belong to the younger generation.
Absolutely.
And the second thing is, we have at least done some sneak previews in America. And although it's very interesting to look at their perception of how much violence there is in the film, a great deal of concern from parents about the levels of violence, even though we have kept rigorously to that PG certificate. But the kids who have seen it so far have given it very, very strong ratings. So, you know, things are in place, hopefully, for a success over there.
It doesn't feel like a violent film. It doesn't feel like you've got the balance wrong. What is it that they would be objecting to? I mean, very, very rarely does Alex Rider have a gun in his hands.
Never at all, I think. Briefly at the end. And he doesn't point it at any person. He's pointing at an object. And this, of course, is absolutely deliberate. Alex never gets a gun in the books, nor in the films. I found the whole thing absolutely fascinating, that you know, when you're in the sound recording studio and a character hits another character, if you tweak the microphone or the sound level up to sort of 7, you're suddenly into PG-12 and beyond. If you bring it down to 5 and it's still more of a slap than a punch, and there isn't too much of a sort of ugh from the guy who gets hit, you're back into PG. So what we've got in this is, there is a certain amount of violent activity, I mean, shootings, chasings, explosions, and all that sort of stuff. But what you're not getting is sort of the gut-wrenching effect or really seeing any of the consequences. So it flies by and therefore keeps into that PG category.
Does this mean that these books are going to dominate your life for the foreseeable future? I mean, the horror series that you're doing for kids, for example, is that going to have to take a bit of a backseat?
I've been working on that all day today. I'm actually at the very end of the third book in that series, Night Rise, and I'm just 2 or 3 chapters from the end. And until I came to the studio, I was typing away in my studio. And as soon as I leave here, I'm going back to it, because I hope to have it finished before the end of next week. So no, the horror series will continue. I'm in a slightly odd situation now of having to write Alex Rider films. I've already started work on the screenplay for Point Blank at the same time as new Alex Rider books. And that sort of is a quite sort of peculiar experience, because it makes me sort of think, am I writing Alex Pettifer, or am I writing Alex Rider? Am I writing Sir Alan Blunt, or am I writing Bill Nighy? It's sort of a, it's difficult.
Does that
can I just ask? I take it there's no legal issue with calling the film Point Blank, what with there being a very famous John Borman movie and indeed previous book called Point Blank.
But there's Point Blank with a C in my case. Actually Point Blanc. It's White Point, which is the name of a mountain in France.
I stand corrected.
I want to talk to you just while Mark is with us about horror. Right. Mark knows a little bit about horror. In fact, he's the only person I've ever met who has a doctorate in horror fiction.
That's interesting.
Because there aren't that many people who write horror for kids. And I read the first in this series that you're writing.
Ravensgate.
You came in and you talked about Ravensgate. And it's a very interesting challenge because it's no doubt, it is extremely unsettling. And it is scary, you know, even for a middle-aged man reading it. You're thinking, actually, this is... not quite sure I like this. What are the other? Are there similar rules that what you can and what you can't do if you're writing really scary books for kids?
Well, it's the middle-aged man you mentioned that is the problem because
that's
the kids. Well, it's not you actually. It's the librarians. It's the teachers. It's the parents. In England, again, unfortunately, especially in America, who if they feel the book is too objectionable, too scary, too dark, it'll never reach the kids. So what you're trying to do is you have to do a balancing act between giving the kids what they want, which is, I think, a fair amount of gore and scare, and yet being responsible to the parents and not being too horrific. I've written actual horror stories, short horror stories, and I've done Ravensgate now in this new series, and I think I've managed the balancing act just about okay. But it is a balancing act, and you do have to be careful.
Have you read any horror books for kids, Mark?
Well, I think I've read loads of horror books for kids, but that starts with things like The Brothers Grimm, which are, of course, you know, full-on horror stories, as are, you know, all those nursery rhymes you get told, like Little Tom Suckerthumb. Those are essentially horror stories. Those are essentially slasher stories. That, incidentally, is where the Freddy Krueger character came from. And, of course, everyone is familiar with Dark Materials, which, of course, is now being made into a film. The new Terry Gilliam film, incidentally, Tideland, which I would suspect is going to be an 18-certificate film, which he thinks is aimed largely at sort of, you know, at young teenage girls. I mean, there is a disparity between what young audiences actually, you know, are willing to take and want and what the general perception about what is acceptable for young audiences is. I mean, I grew up reading, you know, ghost stories, horror stories, and of course, it was as soon as I was, you know, 11 or 12, I was reading The Exorcist because that's the kind of thing that got passed around schools, and that's which is clearly, a, you know, a grown-up horror novel. The fact of the matter is, kids have a propensity to understand and enjoy those things. And there is a great problem, both here and in America, I think it's much worse in America, of assuming that we should protect kids in a way which means that we shouldn't give them anything that's challenging, anything that's alarming, anything. So, you know, there's a line in Maisie, you know, Maisie, the kid's character Maisie, you know, sometimes it's good to be frightened. And the fact is, it is. Most kids love horror. I grew up on horror. Most of my friends did as well. It's good for you.
You should try Darren Shan, Mark. I mean, he's the master of it. And some of the stuff that he gets away with, I think he lashes on the blood in a way that I wouldn't dream of doing, but he somehow gets away with it on both sides of the Atlantic.
Right. I mean, but do you think his stuff is it's pitched right for kids, or you think when you say he layers it on too much, or...?
Lord Lost is the last book of his I read. I was quite concerned about it when my son read it, but he loved it, of course, and wasn't troubled by it. And, you know, Darren is doing the same thing as I am. He's getting boys reading and just doing it his way.
Just before you go, Anthony, because our time's virtually up, and then Mark will rant about all kinds of things, but something that I suspect we'll all agree on, Bill Nighy. One of the many reasons for seeing your film is that it's a Bill Nighy film. He's in it, and I think I'd go and see anything with Bill Nighy in it because, he still has the same mannerisms in your film that he does in Pirates of the Caribbean, where he has this
without the squid, sir,
extraordinary squid face, but he still has that way of standing and the little way of shaking his head. You're thinking, that's Bill Nighy under there. What's he like to work with?
He is. Everyone who talks about Bill Nighy says how charming he is, and you think he can't be, but he is. He's just one of life's good guys. He's totally pleasant. He remembers names. He doesn't have any high horses. He seems to enjoy both the work he does and the films he makes and his life. One of the great pleasures of working on the film for me was meeting him. He was a hero of mine after Love, actually. The only reason, in fact, to see that film, in my view. But he's just great in it.
What about Mickey Rourke?
I think we've run out of time, Mark.
I think we're going to leave it there. You can fill in the blanks. So, listen, Anthony, it's good to have you on the programme again.
Very nice to be back, Simon. Thank you very much.
Wish you all the best for your opening weekend in the UK. Box office top 10 this week at 10, District 13.
Running, jumping, bouncing off things and shooting, followed by a lecture about how violence won't solve anything from French writer Luc Besson, who should know better.
9 is The Da Vinci Code. 8 is Golmaal.
Which I haven't seen, they haven't shown it to us, but I have it on good authority that it is a comedy starring Ajay Devgan and Rajesh Hirji. So if anyone's seen it, please send us an email and let us know what it's like.
The Lake House at 7.
Rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. Sandra Bullock's career continues down the dumper, which is a shame because I like Sandra Bullock. Keanu Reeves is no help to anyone.
We have the Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift at number 6.
I really hope this is the end of the Fast and the Furious franchise now, because this is now the third one and it was terrible. Unfortunately, it took a huge amount of money, which kind of guarantees that there will be a fourth one. I don't know what else they could do unless they take the cars to the moon. Actually, that's a very good idea. Fast and the Furious 4, everyone goes to the moon, we don't have to watch it.
5, Just My Luck.
Lindsay Lohan doesn't successfully make the transition to adult roles, in my opinion. The film still performed better than I expected it to. So McFly, at least on their home ground, seemed to be doing some good on the screen. I thought it was terrible.
The Wind That Shakes the Barley at 4, bit of Marxist good. History.
Yeah, but good to see it doing well. I mean, in terms of box office doing well, I mean, obviously we all know about the critical fuss about it, but I think Ken Loach is always an interesting director. I think the film is beautiful to look at. You know, hats off to Barry Aykroyd, very good performance by Cillian Murphy. Go and see the film, and then afterwards argue about the politics. But the film is made to start you talking, and it does do that.
Over the Hedge at 3.
You know, it's fine. It's okay. It's nicely put together, CG animation. It's a bunch of famous Hollywood stars doing the voices. I just think it's empty, and I think it's unmemorable, and I think it's not Toy Story, and I think it's not Cars, although I seem to like Cars more than many critics.
Superman Returns, number 2.
Thumbs up for me. Thumbs up. There was I worrying about the whole thing, and then it's slightly too long. Yes, there are moments in it when it creaks a little bit, but I like the Superman franchise in that I like the old films. I actually like Dick Donner's Superman very much, and I thought that Bryan Singer did an interesting job with it. I thought that he actually, you know, put some heart and soul into the character. I like the fact that the Superman is as naive and as positive as it is. I like the throwback retro look of it all. I don't think Kate Bosworth is up there with Margot Kidder, but I think he's Mr. Ralph, apparently as it's pronounced, is a very, very good substitute for Christopher Reeve.
Martin in Manchester, having seen Superman Returns and really enjoyed it, I'm surprised good. Mark didn't mention the religious imagery in last week's rather cautious review. In the opening credits, it says, based on the characters created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster of DC Comics, but it omits God, he of the Bible, who really ought to be claiming copyright.
Yeah.
I'm not religious myself, but I actually found the crucifixion and resurrection imagery rather powerful.
There is an awful lot of religious symbolism. And to be honest, I think the reason I didn't mention it was just it seemed so glaringly obvious to me that I forgot to point it out. But, I mean, yes, it is a very big deal. In fact, Philip French's review in The Observer talked about it at quite great length, and Philip and I then talked about it. There is a death and resurrection sequence. There is clearly a crucifixion, a crucifixion imagery in it. It's all there. It's not even subtext. It's supertext.
I think it was A.C. Grayling, Anthony Grayling, the philosopher, who started that whole debate going in an article that he had, saying basically we get the Superman that we deserve for our times. You know, we have it's either a mafia based one, or it's a communist conspiracy based one, or it's a religious one. And
well, there's always been debates about what Superman means. Of course, but there was a point in the 1950s when Superman was being decried as being a fascist icon by some, in inverted commas, liberal commentators who thought that he was a very bad thing, particularly over here. Frederick Wortham didn't like the Superman comics at all and thought they were indicative of, you know, extreme right wing. But I think he's wrong, incidentally.
No,
I think
really?
Superman, no, yes. Far be it from me. But I like Superman. What can I say? I like the colour scheme. I like the blue and the red.
Okay. And at number 1, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. And the point is about all this, because I wasn't here last week. So our last discussion on this point was at Wimbledon. The point is, it's just not as bad as you said it was.
Did you see it?
Yes. I took. You remember, I said I was going to take
a party
of boys to go and see it, and they had a good time. You know, it's far too long, and by the end, I really wanted the squid to eat Johnny Depp completely.
Mm-hmm. Didn't he annoy the heck out of you?
But you know, it's not as bad as you said it was. And that's the truth of it.
No, but there we go. That one of the film's staunchest defenders, somebody who had everything invested in liking it because he took a party of kids. The best you can say about it is it's not as bad as you said. I have yet to find somebody who actually liked that film, and here's my point. I may dislike it more than most people. In fact, I may dislike it more than everybody. But I have yet to find someone who likes it as much as I dislike it.
There'll be an email, and it'll come to mayo@bbc.co.uk.
So, listen, just to close business on Stormbreaker. So, I think in the end, is that all right if I just...
Absolutely.
Fine, OK. So, in the end, here's what I think. You know, I think it's fun, and I think it's I think it plays young. I think that violence issue, which Anthony Horowitz raised, is interesting because there is, you know, people get killed. There's one moment you've seen the film, right? There's one moment when a thing with a bunch of people in it falls off the edge of a cliff, and you think, wow, that's very callous. And then the next scene, somebody says, you know, bones were broken, people could have got killed. So it is clear that they understand what they're doing. I think, you know, like a lot of British movies, it's rough around the edges, and it's creaky and it's crunky in a way that I don't have a problem with at all, because I kind of rather like that Britishness about it. That's what worries me about the American response. I mean, some of the performances are terribly wooden and hammy, not in a bad way, in a kind of pantomimey way. And I think the key thing is that it will play to a young audience. I don't mean very young audience, because it is scary. There are, you know, there's a couple of monster bits in it, and there are some action scenes which are sustained peril, as the BBFC like to refer to it. And I also don't think from a design point of view it looks anything like as good as Thunderbirds. But as we all know, Thunderbirds died a horrible death, and I was one of its only champions. And I said, this will obviously do much better than that. So, you know, with all the creakiness about it, I think it's generally a thumbs up, and I think it will be a big hit here. I just wait to see what happens in America. You liked it, right?
Yeah, no, I thought it was terrific, and for a whole number of reasons. Bill Nighy is fantastic. Alex Pettifer's good. I mean, I can imagine the Americans really liking Alex Pettifer.
Yeah, the only thing is,
because he's good looking, he's quite posh in a Hugh Granty kind of way. I would imagine that they'll take to him.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's very, very good looking. You know, staggeringly sort of, you know, handsome young man running around in the middle, which I imagine will do the box office no end of good. Now, I haven't read the books, but apparently in the books he's not quite that dashing.
That's right. Well, Anthony said in the interview, he said his only question about Alex Pettifer was that maybe he was too good looking to play Alex Rider, because the whole point about Alex Rider is that he's just an ordinary bloke who becomes a reluctant spy.
So. But how old were the kids that you went with?
Well, we did a family trip, so we did 14 and 12.
Okay, and all fine with the levels of violence and gunplay, no problem at all.
They thought it was true. I mean, it's fairly mild. I mean, I think. I mean, I don't think they'll. I mean, maybe this is an American British difference, but I don't think there will be any parents. We were in Pirates of the Caribbean, as I told you. There were parents taking their 5- and 6-year-olds in there. I mean,
which is nuts.
Well, you just think it is, as we've said many times before, it's a 12A for a reason, dummy. anyway, we must do some reviews. Just ahead of that, though, Tony in Bedford, you wanted people who liked Pirates of the Caribbean.
As much as I disliked
it. I saw Pirates of the Caribbean this morning with my three sons. Overlong, repetitive and wooden. I don't think they're the three kids.
No.
They're very strange names for the kids. But the boys loved it. So there you go. Yeah. Maybe you need to talk to kids,
that's
Mark.
Not going on the poster. And Kermode Drinking Gamers, take a drink.
So before we get lost in a maze and a pile of emails which are coming in, which we'll get to in just a moment, what do you want to review first?
Well, shall we do the breakup?
Well, why don't you do the breakup and then I'll... Be chippy about it.
So, The Breakup, new Jennifer Aniston movie. Well, actually, no, to be honest, not really the new Jennifer Aniston movie, more the new everybody else in the movie other than Jennifer Aniston. But for the purpose of this, it's a Jennifer Aniston movie with Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn wrote the story. He's also one of the co-producers. It's kind of very much his project, but she's the person who all the publicity has been attached to. And, of course, you cannot have missed, there's been loads of stuff in the tabloids about Jennifer and Vince real on-off, you know, in real life as opposed to in the movie, which is clearly all to do with just puffing the movie. Movie was surprisingly a huge success in America. It's taken over $100 million, which nobody really expected it to do. Story is Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston at the beginning of the movie get together, they become lovers, they move into a flat, and then very early on they start bickering. So we are out of the good bit of the relationship very quickly. And then very early on in the movie, they have a dinner party at which Vince is less than helpful, at which Jennifer is slightly chippy. And after the parents leave at the end of it, they have a great big row, which ends up with them saying, that's it, it's all over, we're not going to speak to each other anymore. But they can't move out of their apartment because the apartment is worth too much. So they end up living in the apartment together despite hating each other. Those who have seen War of the Roses will know this scenario anyway. Now, I went into this expecting to hate it, partly because I hate the poster, which I don't know whether you've seen the poster, but it's Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston sitting on
it. How can you hate that poster? It's just a couple of people with a line down there.
Yeah, it's, but I'll tell you exactly what it is. That poster is a water cooler poster. That is an issue-tainment poster. That is the tagline is pick a side. And it's one of those posters that says, hey, come and see this movie, and then afterwards have a discussion about which one you side with. Do you side with the bozy old bloke who wants to play pool and drink beer with his buddies, or do you side with the career woman who's actually doing a really good job looking off the house and bloody bloody, but it's, and then talk about it at the water cooler next day at work, just drives me nuts. Every time I see that poster on the tube, I just want to scream, which is quite a lot. That's a lot of screaming. However, went to see the film, and hey, you know what? It's actually not bad. It's not good, but it's not bad. And there are a number of reasons why it's not bad. The first one is that Jennifer Aniston is fairly rubbish in it. I don't think she's a great big screen actress. There is something about her that just doesn't work on the big screen. Apparently, she's very good on the small screen. I'm not familiar with her small screen work. I've never seen an episode of Friends. I'm not going to start now. Apparently, it's finished anyway.
You've never seen an episode of Friends?
No, why? Why would I watch Friends? I mean, I've heard that terrible theme tune by the Rembrandts. Why would I want to watch the programme? It's a bunch of people, you know, being friends. I mean, I have real friends.
Can I just say, as a TV reviewer, you're not cutting the mustard?
No, but if I want to talk to friends, I'll go next door, or I'll go to the pub. Anyway, moving on. I don't think she's great on the big screen. I've never seen anything with her in that I was really convinced by. And recently she did this kind of strange sub-Fatal Attraction erotic thriller thing in which she played a femme fatale in which she was absolutely terrible. But Vince Vaughn is funny. Vince Vaughn inevitably ends up in movies which are not as funny as him. But he is funny. There is something about the way in which he drags his kind of his baggy self around movies, looking for all the world like a slightly overweight, slightly belligerent, slightly difficult, but actually rather funny drunk guy, is entertaining. And in this, you have him and Jon Favreau together. Now, I love the teaming of those two because I was a big fan of Swingers. I actually quite liked Maid as well. Jon Favreau, strangely enough, who, when they made Swingers, Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn both looked like young guys who were kind of quite flash and quite smart. They appear to have grown up in different universes because although their age difference is the same, Jon Favreau has now turned into a guy who is clearly substantially older than Vince Vaughn. I'm not entirely sure how that happened, but he's still funny. He plays the guy who runs the bar to which Vince Vaughn goes to pour out his heart, and he's the guy who's your best and your worst friend. Every time Vince Vaughn says he has a problem with his girlfriend, Jon Favreau says, it's okay, I'll get someone to kill the guy. And Vince Vaughn says, no, I don't want you to kill him. Yeah, no, good, smart move, but I will do that anyway. And he's all that stuff I like very much. All the stuff with Jennifer Aniston and her side of the bargain, her side of the problem, I have a real problem with because I don't buy Jennifer Aniston. And I think that every minute she's on screen, the emotional involvement drops completely to zero. There are also a couple of gags in it that are rather ill-judged. There is an extended sequence in it to do with waxing, to do with a Telly Savalas, which this isn't a, I think the movie's a 12A certificate movie. I just thought, I'm sorry, this is, you're in a whole area here that you don't want to be going into, and worst of all, it's not funny. But for half of the movie, for the half that had Vince Vaughn in it, I was chuckling. And considering how much I expected to think it was a stinker, it's nothing like as bad as I thought. And it has an ending which is not terrible. Apparently they shot another ending, which actually, when I read about it, sounded slightly less terrible. But this is not terrible.
I don't think any of that's going to end up on the poster. The ending is not terrible. Mark Kermode, Five Live. Gary Pilkington says on this, is Mark aware that the film he describes as the death of narrative cinema, in other words, Ice Age, The Meltdown, is currently the 28th most successful film of all time? Plus, just to rub it in, Dead Man's Chest has only been out a couple of weeks and it's already 131.
Yeah, I know.
He's not kidding when he says film critics don't influence the audience. But theme...
But Titanic is the most popular movie of all time. I mean, what are you going to do? You know, to compare the box office of Citizen Kane and Titanic and just lose the will to live, frankly.
Patrick Walsh, on the subject of pirates, Simon, and then he puts in quotes, well, that just about runs a rusty old cutlass through the heart of narrative cinema. So that is what you chant when you've been to see it. Lucy Horn in Worcester. I'm listening online just outside Worcester. Normally, I love Mark's film reviews, but I have to say I loved Pirates 2. I thought it was funny, as did the whole and full cinema, who laughed at the same time as me, and I can't wait for number 3. Johnny Depp is a brilliant actor who can turn his talent to anything. Bring on Pirates 3, says Lucy. Nigel in Edinburgh. I don't even love my mother as much as Kermode hates Dead Man's Chest. So he's asking the impossible to find someone who likes the film to the same extent that he detests it. But was I alone Ronin finding the CGI overload the single worst thing about it. Out of 140 minutes of mildly entertaining hokum, at least 100 must have featured CGI, and I just got sick of it. Bill Nighy's crew were hideous and distracting, and it felt to me like Verbinski felt he had to keep spending money on computer animation just to justify his huge budget. Real life action with real actors, please. And no, I don't include Orlando Bloom in that.
Very good. I mean, although I did think the squid makeup was good, I thought that was one of the three good things about the film. And you can
still see it's Bill Nighy underneath it, which is fantastic.
You can, and that just goes to demonstrate that, you know, motion capture has moved on in leaps and bounds. Again, of course, we have Andy Serkis to thank for that, because he did so much in helping pioneer the real beginning of motion capture with what he did with Gollum and what he then did with King Kong. And the motion capture work on Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, is really very good. It's just a shame that the rest of the movie is really very bad.
The breakup we've done. We've brought you the top 10. What else is new, Mark?
Garfield, A Tale of Two Kitties. It's obviously, we're coming up to kids' holiday time. Now, the first Garfield movie I rather enjoyed. I'm a big Bill Murray fan, and any movie which has Bill Murray doing the voice of the cat is perfectly all right with me. Incidentally, I'm not familiar with the original strip cartoon, so I don't know whether the newspaper strip cartoon is aimed at adults or kids. Are you aware?
It'll be kids, but it's one that's like Peanuts. You know, it's the kind of thing that grown-ups will read and have a little chuckle, because it has some wisdom to it.
So the first one did kind of okay, and you know, I went and saw it with a bunch of kids, and they laughed, and they all laughed at exactly the same things. They laughed at the cat dancing, they laughed at the cat waving his furry bottom at the camera, they laughed at jokes that were vaguely to do with the toilet, and they laughed about the sound of farting. Which, fine, no problem with that. Scooby-Doo, both the Scooby-Doo movies all capitalised on that. Now, because the first Garfield movie did well, we have to have a second Garfield movie, which is just laden with stars. I use the word advisedly, like Billy Connolly and Jennifer Love Hewitt, and of course Bill Murray back as the voice of Garfield. This time Garfield has to go to England, so this is the second London set movie of the week. He has to go to England, where it turns out there is a very posh cat who looks exactly like Garfield living in a castle, and he gets displaced, and Garfield ends up in the castle, blah, blah, blah. So that, hence the title, A Tale of Two Kitties. Ba-boom. See, it's kind of like Prince and the Pauper.
I did get that joke first time.
It's a terrible thing to have to admit, because I don't like saying this about any Bill Murray film, but Garfield 2 is just totally awful. And it's a real shame, because I did go in thinking I am going to get a couple of laughs out of this, and it'll be, you know, be nice kids' entertainment, and there'll be the usual stuff with the cat waving his bum at the camera. And it's a long time before there's any reaction at all. I was there with an audience which had some kids in it, and there was about an hour of silence, and then finally the silence was broken at the moment that a ferret ran up Billy Connolly's trousers. And then they laughed. And you go, well, there you go. You see? It's not rocket science. There are certain things that will just hit the laughter button, and at least before you did them regularly enough, and you had Bill Murray being droll. The problem with it in this film, I actually spent the first 10 minutes of it thinking, that's not actually Bill Murray doing that voiceover, is it? Because it was so lame and so not funny and so not sardonic and so not Bill Murray. I thought they'd got an impersonator in to do him. So I'm very disappointed to say that Garfield 2 is a complete clunker. And it's a real shame, because Garfield 1, I think, was perfectly fine and it did the job, and this doesn't do the job.
This from Steve. What's so good about Citizen Kane anyway, Kermie? It's just a fat bloke mumbling on about newspapers. I don't know where to start.
Yeah, it's the best thing about Citizen Kane is that everyone tells you it's the greatest movie ever made, and you think, oh, I don't want to see it because of that, because I don't want to see any film that people say that about. And then you watch it and you go, you know what? That is actually pretty good.
Mark has no taste. Thunderbirds was rubbish. Pirates was good fun. Jimmy Grantham.
No, it's not. It's not. I'm sorry. It's a simple factual error, okay? Point of order. Thunderbirds is not rubbish. I know the standardly received opinion is that Thunderbirds is rubbish. I know that at least one film critic started their review with the tag with the line 5-4-3-2-1, Thunderbirds are rubbish. It's just factually wrong. It's not rubbish. It's actually a perfectly good and very, very well-designed kids movie.
Dominic, Vince Vaughn is the same in every movie. The Breakup,
yes,
Dodgeball,
is.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Old School. Anchorman, Yawn, boring.
No, it's perfectly true that he is the same in every movie, but he's the same funny in every movie. I don't think he's boring. I mean, I could watch him do that in almost anything. And almost every movie, that at the beginning it says Vince Vaughn, I think, okay, fine. I am at least going to get some entertainment out of this, because he's just funny. But he is the same in every movie, absolutely.
Don't forget, all the reviews available as a podcast. Go to the Five Live website for all the details, or you go to iTunes. I think you're about 26 or something. And the Daily Mail available as a podcast as well. Same rules apply. This from Russ in Bristol. I always love Mark's words of wisdom, and he's mostly spot on, but tell him not to be so negative about Friends, as he has never seen it.
No, never seen it.
Also tell Mark that Jon Favreau was in Friends for a while. So can it really be that bad?
Well, Jon Favreau has been in some very bad films. I mean, of course, Jon Favreau has also become a director. I mean, the most recent thing he directed was Zathura, a space fantasy film. So he's predominantly a director now. He's not predominantly an actor. And he has been in some real stinkers. So it's not like one of those, you know, those rules. It's not like a Richard E. Grant, although we know that that doesn't work anyway. Who did we figure out? Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's not a Philip Seymour Hoffman rule. It is possible for Jon Favreau to be in bad things. And if he's in Friends... I still don't want to see it.
Which you haven't seen.
No, I haven't seen it. So it may be brilliant. It may be brilliant.
We have 4 minutes. And
can I do Little Fish?
Well, if is that next on the list?
Yes, if that's okay, unless there's something else you would like me to...
Little Fish is fine, especially as I've got no idea what it's about.
Fine, okay, Little Fish.
Is it about a small fish?
It is about small fishes used for, small fish-shaped packages used for placing drugs into. We had Martin Henson from the film on last week. It's an Australian movie, an Antipodean movie, actually, because it's New Zealand and Australian co-production. I think Antipodean means other side of the world, in covering both of those two territories. And it's received many awards in Australia, many Australian Film Institute awards. And there was a piece in the paper recently saying that it was being touted for Oscars, although I have to say I think that's rather overstating the case. Cate Blanchett stars as a middle-aged woman who works in a video store, who's trying to get her life together. She's a recovering drug addict. She is attempting to get a business loan to start a new business and break away from the cycle of stuff which has haunted her family. However, around her spiral a cast of characters, all of whom are messed up in strange and peculiar ways, not least of whom is an old boyfriend who's been away for 4 years, comes back into her life, bringing with him all the bad drug stuff that was the thing that messed up her life before. Now, on the good side, it's a proper film. I mean, it's an art house work. It's not a mainstream work. It's directed by Rowan Woods, who made a film before called The Boys, which is terribly, terribly grim. This has a slightly more redemptive ending, although I have to say I don't think the redemption quite works. Cate Blanchett's central performance is really good. She's very fine in it as well. And Martin Henderson, I was really surprised by. He's currently on stage as well, and I think he's a good actor. The guy who plays the returning boyfriend has an accent problem. He's meant to have been in Hong Kong for 4 years, but after they finished making the film, they realised that, in fact, his accent was strangely Midwestern, so they changed the place that he'd been away to for a while to Vancouver, so that now he's been away in Vancouver for a while, therefore kind of explaining why it is that his accent seems to leap across great divides at a single bound. Overall, I think the film's heart is in the right place, and I think there are many good elements in it. I think Sam Neill's performance is, you know, is very impressive. I mean, he's always a good actor. I think that Hugo Weaving does another one of those Hugo Weaving roles in which he's unrecognisable from previous work. I don't think, as a whole, it's a masterpiece, and I don't think it's quite the film that everyone seems to think it is. But it is a proper film. It is a film made by people who are interested in film as opposed to profit. I don't see it making a huge splash at the box office. It is, in the end, an art house movie. It's too contrived for its own good, and the script is a shade too televisual for its own good. But it is at least trying to do something, and Cate Blanchett's performance is worth the price of admission.
So Viva Zapatero or Regular Lovers, you've probably got one or...
I'll do Regular Lovers. I'll be very, very quick about this. Regular Lovers, right, is a black and white French movie about a bunch of horrible teenagers during the riots, 1968, and it's 3 hours long. And here's how it went: first hour, I hate these people. Second hour, I really hate these people. Third hour, I am going to get up and smash the screen if these people don't get off it soon. Then I left. That was the end of the film. It was one of the least edifying experiences I have ever had in the cinema. Critics are drooling over it, saying, oh, it's magnifique, it's a masterpiece. As far as I'm concerned, it's a reason for putting a divide across the Channel Tunnel. It's everything that's wrong with French cinema.
Okay.
And it's 3 hours long!